Welcome to the podcast, One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 18. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, here with my co-host, Michael Winterberg.
How's it going, Andrew?
Very well. Great to sit with you. How are you today?
All right.
So we're going to talk about a bug that's been kind of nibbling at your thoughts. Mm-hmm. How's that for translation?
Juk barash? Not bad.
Yeah. You know, almost completely for my first few decades of life, the concept of Moshiach, the Messiah, did not enter my consciousness. The exception was when I'd hear a Jewish person respond to a Christian person, an evangelist, or an idea who claimed that the Messiah had already arrived. That's really when I would hear the term and the idea, and the Jewish person would say, not yet. Mm-hmm. You know, we're waiting. And that's really pretty much the extent of it. I had no context. Then these past, say, 10 to 15 years or so, I've been exposed to Messiah ideas, Messianic ideas, as either apocalyptic or some prediction of a reinstatement of an idyllic or idealized Davidic kingdom. So I'm wondering if you could set us going with the context of what we're talking about when we say Moshiach or Messiah or redemption.
Well, you know, it's before we even get to trying to articulate it, I think it's worth, it's worth noting that we tend not to articulate it. I have a friend and colleague who I work with in Cleveland, Tina Keller, who she works in the Cleveland Federation and in her Reform Temple. And she said, when I ask a Christian kid about things about afterlife or Messiah, they can articulate them. They know. Teenagers know. When I talk to a Jewish kid, they don't really have anything to say because it's so ignored. And I find this very surprising because supposedly, if you look at rabbinic tradition, these ideas are supposed to be at least somewhat central. And I want to separate sort of the two. When you get to the medieval rabbinic discussions, there becomes a disagreement on terminology. So let's ignore terminology. Let's define our terms for now to make life easier. If we're talking about Olam Haba or world to come, we're going to be talking about afterlife, the journey of the soul after the death of the physical body. If we're talking about the Messianic era, we're talking about Yemot HaMashiach, then we're talking about a continuation of history after a transformative event, and human history will continue on. And while I think there is an argument to be made that Judaism has such a this-worldly orientation that afterlife discussions remain very vague, Jews don't use at all the same level of metaphor that Christians or Muslims use. In fact, if I understand Islam correctly, it's not even metaphor. Like, they think the afterlife, it's not metaphorical. There are physical gardens with wine and women and etc. Christians have pearly gates and St. Peter and that sort of imagery.
Well, right? Heaven, and then also on the opposite side being hell, purgatory and hell.
Right. Oh, and limbo and all sorts of, depending on your particular orientation or denomination, you'll have different descriptions. Judaism is extremely weak on articulating those. We don't have those to turn to. Sometimes you'll see people who say, well, I don't think Judaism really has hell. That I hear all the time. But there, so then what does Judaism have? And I think we should probably separate the two conversations, one about afterlife and one about Messiah. I think there's an argument to be made that if you keep the afterlife discussions to a minimum, then you focus on this world and building it and improving it and perfecting yourself. I don't understand exactly why the Messianic conversation is taboo, other than for historical reasons. In other words, I think there's a religious reason to not articulate a lot about a spiritual world, to not create a lot of metaphor, especially since it shouldn't necessarily impact your daily life very much. But the Messianic idea is supposed to impact your daily life. And I'll give you two examples. One of them is in the Amidah prayer, the central prayer of Jewish ritual. there are a few prayers that directly relate to this. You are supposed to pray for the righteous to be rewarded. You're supposed to pray for evil to be defeated. You're supposed to pray for the coming of the Messiah, the reinstatement of the Davidic kingdom, the full rebuilding of Jerusalem. So,
and specifically the temple.
The temple in the daily Amidah gets mentioned in Yerushalayim, but it seems not to be the focus, I don't think. Is that
on Shabbat? When does it, is the temple?
Certainly in Musaf. Every Musaf prayer goes into detail about, because Musaf, that extra prayer on Shabbat and festivals, is a, it doesn't just correspond to the morning, afternoon, and evening prayers, Shachrit, Mincha, and Musaf, correspond to the times that sacrifices were given in the temple. That's a time correspondence. Musaf is talking about that extra sacrifice. So Musaf always talks a lot about the temple.
Okay. I still would like it if you could say more what Mashiach means in defining the term before we talk more about when it's in, the concept is active or not.
Well, yeah, we haven't articulated it yet. And I can't, so I don't want to be a tease, but before we get to it, I do want to just marvel at the lack of articulation that we have. Not because it's not in Jewish sources, but I do think that's weird, and I would even say problematic.
Well, after we do define the terms, I'll read something from Gershom Scholem.
Okay.
On the topic that maybe sheds a little light on that.
If we had sponsors, we could say, and we'll define it after this.
Right.
But we don't.
Deek, deek, deek. Do, 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 do.
Also, the Talmud mentions that when a person does go, in one of their afterlife metaphors, one of the things they say is a person is asked if he dealt in business honestly, if he built a family, if he anxiously awaited the coming of the Messiah. In other words, these are supposed to be central to a Jew's life. So I think, and I'm not sure, I think there may be a historical cause, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into it, but I think that the Shabtai Tzvi incident of the 17th century made the topic of Messiah very problematic to bring to the fore in everyday Jewish life. The false Messiah who led so many people to believe him and caused so much damage to people's lives, personally, communally, financially, some cases physically, that messianic talk sort of became, if not underground, at least something that was referred to but not actually discussed. So I think that if you want to go to, what are the sources? Why did Jews believe in the Messiah? An idea not clearly articulated in the Torah. It's because of the prophets. If you go particularly to Isaiah, you know, like chapter 12, places like that, he talks about this world. And then you have the medieval scholars debating, are they talking in metaphor or are they talking about reality? So before we get into the metaphors, anytime you have a discussion like that, right? Like, for instance, the wolf lying with a lamb. So you're going to have a medieval argument over, does that mean that literally wolves and lambs will be able to, like wolves will stop being carnivorous? Right. Or does it mean that nations will live in peace, and that from our place in history, that seems as absurd as a wolf not eating a lamb would be one nation not causing military friction with another.
Like, no, and that's actually in the prophecy of the plowshares will become...
And that's it. So I think...
swords into plowshares.
Correct. So I think whether you believe the metaphors are going to happen in reality or are they just metaphors, certainly what the metaphors represent is intended, right? In Hebrew, that's a mashal and an imshal. If the metaphor... Do we take the metaphor literally? The imagery literally, I should say, because I'm already loading my my bias by saying, calling it a metaphor. Do I take the imagery literally? Well, that's a disagreement. But the reality that the world will be at peace, that's not up for discussion. So to me, the clearest presenter of the prophetic idea of the Messiah, to me, is Maimonides, because his approach, he narrows out the basic rationalist beliefs that you have to accept if you believe the prophets are uncovering deep truths. And they are that the Jewish people will rebuild their homeland, they will ingather to it and create a country that is successful in any number of ways. So much so that I don't know that the word superpower would be the right word, but that's a modern term. But the Jews will become this model nation that will help every other nation state orient itself in a more productive way.
And didn't you say that even if it could even survive and thrive after the BDS movements is finished or something like that?
Well, part of overcoming the BDS movement is activating those prophecies, right? Okay. If you're a Zionist, then you believe that the Jews returning to their homeland is essential to the Jewish future. If you're a religious Zionist, and there are all different types of religious Zionism, that's a discussion for another day, but at the very least, you believe that you are moving the ball forward towards the goal of what the prophecy is. You're moving things forward. You're helping those prophecies come true through action.
So can we say, let's say more about the prophecies themselves. Like, what is this idyllic Davidic kingdom? What is, I understand if a world of peace, that's...
With the Jews as a linchpin, sort of as a vanguard to helping the world. Not necessarily, it's not even implied that the Jews will be running things or in a hierarchical way, bossing anybody. But that their example will be a useful model for others, and so they will be a resource.
So this would be the light unto the nation, being a light,
light unto the nations. Yeah, okay. That's the prophetic term. So that's how that prophetic term is understood. A return of a Davidic kingdom, whatever that means. And here you have, even on the rationalist side, an argument about what a returned monarchy means. Does that mean that that will be the form of government, or that will be some form of leadership that doesn't have power?
One thing that came up in a couple different sources, including Gershom Scholem's work on dealt with the messianic thinking, is that the idyllic Davidic kingdom, he says idyllic because, or idealized, is that the Davidic kingdom never reached the state that the idea of the messianic kingdom would reach.
So I think it briefly did. In the blink of an eye, there's a moment in the Bible in the First Temple period where the queen of Sheba, Malkat Shva, comes to visit Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. That is it. And he's helpful to her. And all sorts of legends arise in Midrashim about what happened during that interaction. But that interaction itself, the Davidic king in a beautifully built Jerusalem, which has become a waypoint for others to come. And again, she's not surrendering, she's not becoming a vassal to Solomon. She's asking Solomon for guidance in how to run Shva. You have a moment where the dream is realized, and then the ball is fumbled and not taken into the end zone by Solomon, who misruns this opportunity that he has, doesn't provide for continuation. You have a similar moment in the Second Temple period. Interestingly, a queen named Shlom Tzion, a name pretty similar to Shlomo, who runs a kingdom of peace. You have...
And she was married to the Hasmonean dynasty.
Yeah, she was also part of the family, as in many monarchies, marriage stays in the family. But when she's widowed and left in charge of the country is the only brief moment in the Hasmonean dynasty where you actually have Queen Helene of Adiabene converts and has sends resources when there's a famine in Israel. She sends in appreciation for what she got from, at the time, it's called Judea. So she helps support Judea. So you have these moments where kingdom running well. It's a kingdom of, and this is what the prophets emphasize, a kingdom of tzedek and mishpat, of righteousness and justice. You're running a kingdom based on such righteousness and justice, guided so well, that it pervades, and that leads to a successful society. That successful society becomes a model nation. The Jews return to the land. There's some form of Davidic, that's the word I'm looking for, leadership, and a return to the temple. The temple is rebuilt, and its activities resumed. And what I think is important about that is that people tend to look at that as, well, now history is sort of done. We did it. We made it to the Messianic Age. And I think what the prophets, at least as I understand what the prophets are saying and what the medieval scholar philosophers are saying, what they're saying is that's the beginning. In other words, well, I'll switch from football to baseball metaphors. The period we are in now of history...
Wait, but why are you calling it a metaphor? I mean, isn't baseball and football truth? So are you just imagery? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, because I'm such a jock that I always turn to sports imagery to help me. So all of human history so far is sort of spring training, getting the human race and civilization to a place where it's ready to actually get down to the work of what it is we're supposed to do. And you see that imagery really, for example, in the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which we talked about very early in our podcasting history, this imagery of the whole world working together. If money and energy and resources and time weren't spent keeping cities from bursting in flames or financing Middle Eastern nations and tribes from fighting wars against each other, if all those resources and all that human energy was and capital was turned towards just improving things, my gosh, you know what the human race will accomplish. And that,
right, even just the percentages of different nations' GNP that's put towards military defense and offense and everything
gone now, mm-hmm. diverted to cancer research,
and aid education, research,
space exploration, setting up.
Sure.
And I want to just make one more point. We've talked about different ideas that the Jews contributed to the world that are pretty uniquely Jewish. This basic idea of progress, that human civilization is going in a direction and the direction is good and will lead to a better future, which is inevitable because it is the plan of God. We, as modern people, think of as just the normal way you look at the world. But it's a uniquely Jewish... You don't have to go all the way back to the age of prophecy. If you go to the Middle Ages, if you were born in the 12th century, then you basically lived the same life as your great-great-great-grandparents, and your great-great-great-grandchildren would live the same lives as you, basically. Socially, economically, technologically. Aristotle doesn't talk about rising through hierarchies. There's a caste system. You're born a slave, you live a slave, your grandchildren will be slaves. It's the Jews who talk about the world is going to a better place. And what the prophets are exhorting the people to do is make that happen.
Right. I want to speak to that for a minute.
Go ahead.
Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in a series called The Faith Talks, it was a speech that I saw the transcript for. He drew a distinction between cyclical time, which is what you're pointing to. The philosophers were basically in cyclical time, where also the various original peoples and original societies were, you know, cycles of the sun, cycles of the month, the solar year, seasons for farmers and so forth. And Rabbi Sacks says that in the Gift of the Jews, I don't have the author's name, but it's a non-Jewish author who basically says that the key gift that the Jews brought was this idea of linear time, which is only possible when the creator or the divinity is also outside of natural law, so that the creator, Kadosh Baruch Hu, creates the world and natural time, and then also exists outside of natural laws and creates, I'll say more about this linear time, which then history comes into, where there's a culmination, where progress, human progress, can move towards a fulfillment of really individual and then collective possibility in what is, you know, what the purpose of humanity is for. And that this is there's a distinction here, which is in cyclical time, there's tragedy. Like if you look at what the theater of the Greeks and the literature that, and you even told me this months ago, Michael, that there's no Hebrew word for tragedy. And that what actually this type of time brings in, and this whole process is hope. And that is was new for society, because there's a hope for progress, there's a hope for redemption.
Well somewhat ironically, I think that the modern sense of hope and progress comes post-Enlightenment. It's actually part of a secular humanist attempt to make a better world, and it's the religious mindset, for the most part, I'm oversimplifying obviously, that looks at the world as being lost in cyclical time, that we're just waiting for things to change. The world doesn't really get better. In fact, the more it changes, the more scary it is. There's a sense of fear of change. So, the cliche of God working in mysterious ways is that for whatever reason, it's the secular humanist part of the world that's fighting for change and improvement.
Right.
Yeah. Improving the relationships between races and equalizing the relationship of the genders, like all of that. So that while its origins may be in the rich religious spiritual history of the Jews, I would say that religion, in many ways, not always, in many for many religious people, Jewish or not, progress is part of their religious mission, but for many religious people, it isn't.
Well, there's a couple things that brings up for me. One is the idea of progress now, when we use that word, it's been misused or mishandled or degraded to mean pure economic progress and economic growth, where what this conversation we're talking about, when we're talking about progress, we're progressing to more full...
Tzedek u'mishpat. It's the
yes.
actualization of tzedek, a world of tzedek and mishpat, right. Of righteousness and justice.
Right. One thing Rabbi Sacks said in that talk was that if a Greek oracle were to predict something and it came and it failed, it didn't come true, then that was a failure. But if a Jewish prophet predicts something and it doesn't happen, it's possibly a success. For example, Jonah, is that when he's sent to the non-Jewish, non-Israelite city of Nineveh, and he flees that, he tries to avoid that, and then he finally warns them, and they do repentance, and God really changes the decree and does not destroy the city. He's upset. Why did you humiliate me? This is actually the possibility of prophecy is to actually have us change.
Well, a negative prophecy, right? A positive prophecy has to come true, or
okay,
your credentials. That's something an argument Jeremiah has with his name is escaping me. I'll remember it later, but why do we avoid this talk in our religious life? We're not part of the problem that we have when we discuss the Messiah is if we view it mystically, if we take the metaphor as reality, the imagery, and we focus on that, that's dangerous. Look, I don't want to be disparaging of people's I'll tell you something that gets under my skin, and that's me. That's my opinion.
I'm not, go ahead. Go right ahead.
The bar mitzvah will be at the Bell Harbor, you know, hotel, unless the Messiah comes by June, and then it'll be in Jerusalem. Which is a cute thing to put on invitations. I think it was even on mine, if I remember correctly. How is the Messiah going to come by June? You're telling me that by this June, there's going to be peace on earth, all the Jews are going to be living in Israel, the temple's going to be functional, there'll be a Davidic kingdom. That's not happening by June.
Right, so...
That's not happening today, or tomorrow, or next year, or 5 years, or 10 years.
Well, okay, I mean, it's interesting, whenever it starts, the conversation goes towards timing. My, you know, 10 years ago, when I was really first presented with, or I was learning Torah with a number of teachers and students who fully believe that there's an imminent arrival of the Messiah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I've been in classes with the proof texts that there's, that if all of history is on a clock, that we are reaching midnight and we're seconds away from midnight, midnight when midnight strikes, it's like that the Mashiach will come. And some say that it's already happened, you know, it's just all the negative things happening in the world are proof for what's about to happen, and people are revising the clock so that it doesn't actually pass. I don't even know who I read said, you know, we're already, for centuries ago, there was someone who said, no, we're already past that, so we're talking about something else. Now,
look, people have been predicting that for 2,000 years. I mean, that's when Jesus, as a Jew, was part of a movement that said the kingdom of God was at hand, when the Essenes, which I think he's riffing off, are saying the war between the sons of light and darkness is imminent, and think that the first revolt against the Romans was that war, and that a new era of history was about to begin, they were wrong. You know, it happens in the year 1000. It happens with Shabtai Tzvi with 1666. And I think that's because if you have... I don't know if there will be... Maimonides says there won't be changes of nature and miracles. And others disagree. Okay. Maybe there will, maybe there won't. I'm willing to wait and see. But we agree that the actual historical changes will occur. So the question then becomes, for Jews, do we wait for those changes or do we make those changes happen?
Well, I understand there is a disagreement that that we can or cannot impact that. I saw something that Rav Soloveitchik is one of the teachers who refers to that there's all that is out of our hands, and then but that we still that there's some participation for us to do what we can do.
I think that's the underpinning, or at least the classic underpinning from its origins of religious Zionism, the idea that the Messianic era isn't something you patiently wait for; it's something you work for, it's something you build the conditions for. David doesn't become king of Israel till centuries after Joshua brings the people in. And to say that none of the work to bring the people together, to build the economy, to create some sort of stable community with a level of righteousness ready for the next step for David to step in, all of those centuries of work of stabilizing that community, is that causal? Did that help? Did that create the possibility of the rise of David? Who's the model of a guy who... He had to go through a number of wars to make a secure region. But basically, and you're talking obviously in the Iron Age, so things work differently. A lot of blood had to be shed and things that we today find barbaric before he could get a quiet region that he hands over to his son who can create that stable cultural economic base. But so to me as a religious Zionist, the question has a clear answer. Which is that's the nation's goal. The nation's goal is to work towards it. Which, if you look at the different positions within Orthodoxy, the reason that religious Zionists work hand in hand with all with all forms of Zionism is because religious Zionism sees it all as part of the process of building that condition. It's not, and to Rav Kook, it wasn't like, well, I guess we'll be tolerant and work with people even though they don't understand what they're doing. To Rav Kook, it was, well, look, it was these secular socialists who got the ball rolling, and we're just playing catch up with them. They're leading right. in that area.
Right.
What they're building is something that we as religious people were ignoring. So Baruch Hashem, thank God that these people are standing up and they're leaders at that. We can be leaders at other things, at preaching this message of tzedek and mishpat. We have to see our role as making sure that that becomes the overwhelming character of the state. The nationalists who are trying to rebuild the sense of Jewish national identity. Rav Kook said, we're not doing that well in the religious community. So it's not that I'm tolerant to work with the socialists and the nationalists. It's that thank God I have them helping me and my community because we're not doing it. So this teamwork is what's going to build that better future.
Well, what comes to mind is attention, and even greater than attention, I'd say a real chasm between certain religious and ultra-religious factions and people, communities, and some who are secular, where I just read a colleague's blog. Judy Levinson is a writer and a teacher in Israel, and she wrote an open letter to the mayor of Jerusalem concerning the establishment of Sabbath peace in the city of peace. She lived in Jerusalem for about 25 years. Now she's outside. She wrote about coming to Jerusalem and on Shabbat to pick up a taxi to go to Tel Aviv and be with her family the night before the Brit Milah of her grandson.
Mm-hmm.
And from reading her blog for the last year or two and knowing her, like the love she has for the city and for the country, and it's profound, and this and what happened when she was at getting the into a Monit Shirut, a van of say 10 people who are going to make this travel, that there was a group of ultra-Orthodox men who were screaming at them for the entire time, and it felt physically threatening even to her about their desecration of the Sabbath. The reason I bring this up for the question of what she had that mean is that because these 10 people and the driver are not honoring the Shabbat, that redemption is not going
to
happen.
According to
what they were saying,
they're not honoring the Sabbath from the people who are assaulting them's understanding of the Sabbath, right?
Right, right. So this brings up a larger topic for me, which is about, is redemption, is the coming of the Messiah, and what happens after? Is this inclusive for all Jews? Is this just for people who are pious to a certain extent? How does it work out?
You have to understand from the perspective that I'm talking about. That question is like, what? No. It's not even just the Jews. It's a world so improved, so wonderful, so working on the principles of righteousness. Not that nothing bad happens, not that there isn't illness, not that people don't die. But civilization has elevated to the point that those things become absurd. The idea of assaulting someone because of a religious disagreement. I'll give you some signposts that the progress is working, okay? In America today, racist humor. Now the discussion in America today is, has political correctness gone so far that you can't make jokes that are offensive to Group X? And that's an interesting conversation. And there is humor, as we've discussed, plays an important role in society. If you go back to the 40s, 50s in America, you look at American film, American television, the insensitivity, the racial obnoxiousness you know, Jerry Lewis doing an Asian person and getting huge yuck-yucks and being, imagine being an Asian American family watching that on their television. Or Step and Fetch It if you're an African American family.
Or even All in the Family for, as far as gender.
All in the Family is at least calling it out. And is self-aware that the change is necessary. And is trying to be a catalyst towards that change. Which when we look at it today, I was watching it with my son and he was so offended that, specifically by feminist issues. Or homosexual issues that's raised on All in the Family. And my son, as a 16-year-old, my son Meir was saying, like, he's a complete... Mike Stivic, the liberal, he's like, he's so insensitive. These things are the core. And let's talk on a bigger scale. Oh, what's his name? Pinker, Steven Pinker.
Who is he?
Steven Pinker's a brain scientist, but he writes on a broad set of issues. And one of the things... I'll get you the name of the book so we can post a link to it and some articles about it. But Pinker has done statistical analysis on violent death. And proportionately to the population, per capita, the 20th century, you are much less likely to die by violent death. Your per capita. If you include World War II and the Soviet Union and Communist China and tens of millions of violent deaths, it's still the least violent century in human history.
That's remarkable.
Because most life is going on. And he's saying, stop looking at the world as descending into craziness. These are problems that need to be resolved, but we're going somewhere. And I'll give you another 20th century example. Adolf Hitler. Not a nice fellow, we can agree. Certainly, yes. Yeah, certainly can notch probably the greatest criminal, evil person in human civilization. Had to, when he invaded Poland, set up German troops on the Polish side to shoot at Germans so that they could... He told the world, I'm a man of peace, but I have to defend my country against the Polish incursion. Because in the 20th century, did Alexander the Great do that? Did Genghis Khan do that? Yes. Was there this idea that we're supposed to live in peace and harmony? That even Adolf Hitler had to pay lip service to, and that's all he was doing, was paying.
Right.
Adolf Hitler paid lip service to the idea that nations should respect each other's boundaries and live in a world of peace and harmony. That means there's something different going on in the 20th century that went on in the 19th century and all of human history before that. To see history as moving in a direction and to desperately care about that and want to be part of that, that moves the motion forward. Not on a scale of today or tomorrow or next week, that it's suddenly going to fall upon us. But that the work that we all have to do is to make that future happen. And the faith that that future will happen is the messianic idea in a nutshell. And it should be, it often is a central Jewish idea. Whether Karl Marx's utopian philosophy is related to his Jewish biography, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that. But through, in many ways, through Christianity as well, this idea has expressed itself, that we're working towards this better future. And we're working towards this better future. We have to make it happen.
I think certain sects, even if they're not the largest, that there are some with such loud voices where this idea of exclusivity, that there's only room for so many people after the redemption comes. I've just been exposed to that more often than this kind of hand-in-hand idea.
Well, what I'm arguing is that if that kind of noise enters into a vacuum, and if we're not discussing these things, articulating these things in schools, in culture, to our students, if we're leaving them with these funny, mushy ideas, then you can put whatever weird, mystical, reactionary ideas you want into that empty space, which is exactly what happened with Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi created this idea. The Messiah is going to be this mystical thing whose coming is going to turn the world on its head in a second.
Yeah, there's a piece by Gershom Scholem I'm looking for right now that...
I was at a presentation in Cleveland, Ohio, of a rabbi who was talking about a girl who was educated in the ultra-Orthodox school system, who had a job in New York, and on September 11th, 2001, and couldn't get into Manhattan, saw the smoke, walked back to her house, and there was nobody home. And she sat on her front steps and wept. And when her parents did come home, she was surprised to see them. And they asked her why, and she said, because I assumed that the Messiah had come and everybody was in Israel, and I somehow missed it. Now this teacher, this rabbi was saying, okay, she doesn't understand the idea of Messiah, but how beautiful is it that that was her conception? I gotta say,
it's touching.
There is a beautiful touching side to it, but I come from a mindset that sees that ignorance as disturbing and so deeply problematic to a healthy Jewish identity. What does it even mean, missing the Messiah? I see the beauty in it, and I'm certainly not disparaging this young woman.
Right. No, I hear both what you're saying. I mean, I'm touched by her impact, and also because, I mean, she was experiencing the negative side of kind of how I do when I consider people who are considering themselves to be more pious than others and threatening them, you know, for example.
That has no place in any religious society. Religion's a powerful thing and therefore a dangerous thing. That's why I personally believe that religion should never have institutional or state power of any kind, because it becomes corrupted. Power corrupts. And religion, when it has power, can become corrupt. And any movement is susceptible to that kind of loss of the central narrative. But if the central narrative is, over and over again, building a society of tzedek and mishpat, then behavior like that becomes anathema. If it's that somehow magically things are going to fall from the heaven and the world's going to be groovy, and your driving on the Sabbath is stopping that, my physically assaulting you is going to hasten the coming of a kingdom of tzedek and mishpat,
right,
but your driving your car is going to slow it down, is a perverse misunderstanding of the prophetic prophecy of the messianic era. That to me is exactly the problem.
Let me read from an excerpt from Gershom Scholem's work, and it's bringing up this idea that. And it's definitely, I believe, it's due to Christianity's view on Messiah.
Sure.
The very word
Messiah, the very fact that we use the word Messiah, when it just means king.
Right.
But it has different connotations in English and now in Hebrew because of the Christian...
But isn't there anointing in Moshiach? Isn't it the anointed one?
Moshiach means anointed one, which means it's a synonym for king.
Okay.
David was Moshiach. Saul, who died and his kingdom failed, was the Mashiach.
Okay.
David's men say, attack Saul because he's trying to hunt you down. David says, who am I to put my hands on the Messiah?
Okay, well,
the question in that sentence, which is the first biblical uses of the sentence, Messiah means king. It's a synonym.
So the word apocalypse, we haven't really spoken about
that's
here.
And there's a lot of words.
Right, but apocalypse in the sense... So the Greek word means revelations and disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's meaning revelations and disclosures of God's hidden knowledge of the end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is... Whenever I hear about history and as a trajectory, mm-hmm. and that there's an end point, it creates tension in me because of this idea of there being an apocalypse or some, you know, war that ends all wars that's, you know, related to the divinity and so forth. So what Scholem writes is this: in view of their concept, their meaning, Jewish scholars of the 19th and early 20th centuries, In view of their concept of a purified and rational Judaism, they could only applaud the attempt to eliminate or liquidate apocalypticism from the realm of Judaism. He says, Jewish messianism is in its origins and by its nature, this cannot be sufficiently emphasized, a theory of catastrophe. This theory stresses the revolutionary, cataclysmic element in the transition from every historical present to the messianic future. And later he goes on to say that an undiminished, mighty stream of apocalypticism rushes forth within the Jewish rabbinic tradition. In part, it flows into the channel of the Talmudic and Agadic literature. In part, it finds its expression in its own literature, preserved in Hebrew and Aramaic. And later goes on to question why it then gets taken out. And I think part of the silence about messianism in general has to do with that how much apocalypticism became a part.
Mm-hmm.
And it went underground, was it the Middle Ages? But that it went with the whole, with the mystical literature of the Merkava, the chariot. He writes, the stronger the loss of historical reality in Judaism during the turmoil surrounding the destruction of the Second Temple and of the ancient world, the more intense became consciousness of the cryptic character and mystery of the messianic message.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot he wrote about it. I just kind of pulled those highlights to weigh in on this, that not that I understand what even the apocalypse would, an apocalypse would really be, except more what I've learned from Christianity.
So eschatology or apocalyptic
right.
thinking becomes, there's an inherent conflict in Jesus' message. When Jesus teaches that the meek will inherit the earth, that power is in of itself, the powerful, better to be, a rich man has as much chance getting into heaven as getting a fat man through the eye of a needle, getting a camel through the eye of a needle. I mixed up a Sting lyric with the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But a total abhorrence of power and wealth and what it stands for. If your view of the elevation of the poor and the meek as the ideal, then how's the world going to get better? Because the people with their hands on the levers of power are the problem. So there's going to have to be this spiritual revolution where the world is going to be overturned. This idea has... He didn't make it up. He's drawing on its place. This apocalyptic eschatological thinking at the end of the Second Temple period is pervasive in Judean culture. Not only among the Essenes, the rebels who are fighting the Roman Empire think they're. What made them think they had a chance?
Right.
Was this idea that we're about to be. And I would say that not only does Jewish life in the Christian world absorb some of this martyrdom ideology, and there's nothing we can do, we have to wait for a coming of the Messiah, we have to wait. Not only is that, I think, to a certain degree acculturated from the Jews living in Christian lands, I think the powerlessness of the Jewish experience leads to this. If the Jewish people are not on the stage of history, then discussions of how do we change the world become not only moot, but silly. I mean, I can't even get to the market without having, you know, kids throw garbage at me because I'm a Jew. And that's on a good day. That's if my daughters aren't being raped by Cossacks or whatever. So talk about saving and redeeming the world seems absurd. And so talk of the Messiah becomes this apocalyptic imaginary world that's going to happen. Returning to the stage of history as the Jewish nation means, whether you believe in this stuff or not, that there's what I'm saying is, yeah, there's all these outer layers that build around the messianic idea.
Right.
And those played a role sociologically, anthropologically. I can study them and explain them. But a lot of what this podcast, at least what we hope it's about, is once you discuss the one way or another, at the core, there's something inherently Jewish that we all share, and we should be sharing it, for crying out loud. So however, so often those branches on the sides of how these things play out are fascinating and are worth sharing and discussing. But it's sometimes you need to refocus on what is that core that we share. The core that we share is an optimistic worldview that says that it's the mission of humans to fix the world and make it better and make it a place of righteousness and justice. And in the religious world...
Can you hear our song? I'll say, may that be the divine will.
It is the divine will. We know it is. As an Orthodox Jew, I believe that it is that is the revealed word of God. That is. And
before you go on, and I'll say, for me, as in a different camp, as someone who sees Judaism as the in primary part where you're talking about the tikkun olam, the fixing, the tuning the world, and contributing and social progress and justice, that I see that, right, and share that as essential.
Right. So why in the world are we teaching kids, to whatever degree, that the person, that grandmother driving on Shabbat is the problem, when poverty is the problem, when treatment of minorities is the problem? If you look at Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, what they're concerned with is what's preventing the elevation of the Jewish people and therefore the world is injustice, when you need a world of justice. That should be so central to Jewish education. And in a way, I think...
I agree.
I think that what you're articulating is, I think it's more articulated outside the Orthodox world than in, which I find astonishing and heartbreaking.
You basically just summarize what I was hoping to say in my closing. I have one question, and that's about the vidui, the confession, that religious and many, if not most, non-religious folks say right before, or if they're on their deathbed, if they have the opportunity to, and if someone's there to help guide them in it. And can you say about how that relates to this essence, this topic?
Well, that really relates to, that breaks down to the most intimate individual level. I mean, and that's part of why I wanted to separate the conversation between the world to come and the Messianic era. The Messianic era is talking about human civilization at its largest scale and our place in it as a nation and our individuals as part of that nation. Vidui, confession of a person before the soul leaves the body, boy, you don't get more personal, private, you know, that's at its most atomic level.
Absolutely.
And it's a person trying to acknowledge their failures and receive a moment of comfort in the awareness that all human beings have failures. And so the ritualization of the vidui, I think, is not meant to make you, I hope, is not meant to make you feel guilty or heartbroken, but to make you feel relieved that you're part of a community of the human race, where all of us have failings, and to acknowledge that and enter with a sense of comfort and a freer frame of mind, as whatever that transition is.
Well, thank you for the conversation, Michael.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, I see we will continue.
Yeah, this was a Jute Baruch topic for me.
Yeah, bug in the head. Mm-hmm. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, with my co-host, Michael Unterberg. You are listening to the podcast One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings. Please visit our website, onewayor.com.
Don't forget to check us on social media, at One Way Or Podcast, Twitter, Facebook.
And we'd love to hear your comments, subjects you want us to cover, even things you want to argue about, any of these things. Look forward to being in touch with you soon. And music has been brought to you by Jewish blues pioneer Saul Kay.
Bye.
Goodbye.